Parker turned a page of the character appraisal. When he looked for the weakness in an opponent, Parker had long ago learned to start at the groin. With this man, there was no evidence of any unnatural sexual leanings. Certainly, he was not homosexual, if anything too much, the opposite. There had been at least a dozen significant liaisons with the opposite sex since his divorce. However, all of these had been discreet and dignified. Although three of the ladies had been married, none of them were the wives of his subordinates in the armed services, nor of brother officers, or of men who might be able to adversely affect his career. The women he chose all had certain qualities in common. They all tended to be tall, intelligent, and successful. One was a journalist who had her own syndicated column. Another was a former fashion model who now designed and marketed her clothes through her own prestigious outlets in London and on the continent. Then there was an actress who was a leading female member of the Royal Shakespeare Company. Parker skimmed the list impatiently, for Parker himself had no sympathy nor patience with a man who succumbed to the dictates of his body. Parker had trained himself to be totally celibate, channeling all his sexual energies into pursuits of the mind, while this man's stride, on the other hand, was not above conducting two or three of his liaisons concurrently. Parker moved on to the second area of weakness. Stride's inheritance had been decimated by the punitive British death duties, yet his private income, even after savage taxation, was still a little over £20,000 sterling a year. And when this was added to his salary and privileges as a general officer, it enabled him to live in good style. He could even indulge in the mild extravagance of collecting rare books. And, Parker observed acidly, the greater extravagance of collecting rare ladies. However, there was no trace of an illicit hoard. No Swiss bank accounts, no deposits of gold bullion, no foreign properties, no shares in offshore companies held by nominees. And Parker had searched diligently for them, for they would have indicated payments received, perhaps, from foreign governments. A man like Stride had much to sell, at prices he could set himself, but it seemed he had not done so. Stride did not smoke. Parker removed the old black briar from his own mouth, regarded it affectionately for a moment. It was his one indulgence, a harmless one, despite what the Surgeon General of the United States had determined, and he took the stem firmly between his teeth again. Stride took alcohol in moderation and was considered knowledgeable on the subject of wine. He raced occasionally, more as a social outing than as a serious punter, and the odd £50 he could well afford. There was no evidence of other gambling. However, he didn't hunt, nor did he shoot, traditional pursuits of the English gentleman. Perhaps he had moral objections to blood sports, Parker thought, though it seemed unlikely, for Stride was a superlative marksman with rifle, shotgun and pistol. He had represented Britain at the Munich Olympics as a pistol shot, winning a gold in the 50-metre class, and he spent at least an hour every day on the range. Parker turned to the page of the printout that gave the man's medical history. He must be superbly fit as well. His body weight at the age of 39 was 1 pound less than it had been at 21, and he still trained like a frontline soldier. Parker noticed that he had logged 16 parachute jumps the previous month. Since joining Atlas, he had no opportunity or time for golf, though when he was with NATO, Stride had played off a handicap of 3. Parker closed the folder and played on softly. But neither the sensual polished feel of cool ivory beneath his fingertips, nor the achingly lovely lilt of the music, could dispel his sense of disquiet. Exhaustive as the report was, yet it left unanswered questions, like why Stride had downgraded himself to accept the command of Thor. He was not the kind of man who acted ill-advisedly. Yet the most haunting questions that nagged at Parker were just how strong were his qualities of resilience and independent thought. Just how strongly was he driven by his ambitions and that penetrating intellect, and just how great a threat such a man would present to the evolution of Atlas into its ultimate role. "Dr. Parker, sir," his assistant knocked lightly and entered, "there are new developments." Parker sighed softly. "I am coming," he said, and let the last sad and beautiful notes fall from his long, powerful fingers before he stood up. The Hawker slid almost silently down the sky. The pilot had closed down power at 5,000 feet and made his final approach without touching the throttles again. He was 10 knots above the stall as he passed over the boundary fence, and he touched down 20 feet beyond the chevron markings of the threshold of runway 15, instantly applying maximum safe braking. 15 was the secondary crosswind runway, and the Hawker's rollout was so short that every part of the approach and landing had been screened by the buildings of the main airport terminal, from where Speedbird 070 stood at the southern intersection of the main taxiway. The pilot swung the Hawker through 360 degrees and backtracked sedately up runway 15, using just enough power to keep her rolling. "Well done," grunted Peter Stride, crouching behind the pilot's seat. He was almost certain that nobody aboard 070 had remarked their arrival. "They've prepared a slot for us, with hook-up to the electrical mains at the north." Peter broke off as he saw the apron marshal waving them in with the bats, and beyond him a tight group of 4 men waiting. 3 of them wore camouflage battle dress, and the other the trim blue uniform, cap and gold insignia of a senior South African police officer. The uniformed officer was the first to greet Peter as he came down the Hawker's fold-out air stairs. "Prinsloo," he shook hands. "Lieutenant General." He ranked Peter, but it was a police, not a military appointment. He was a stocky man, with steel-rimmed spectacles, a little paunchy and not less than 55 years of age. He had the rather heavy features, the fleshiness of jowl and lips, that Peter had noticed so often in Belgian and Dutch peasants during his NATO tour in the Netherlands. A man of the earth, dour and conservative. "Let me introduce Commandant Boonzaier." This was a military rank, equivalent to that of colonel, and he was a younger man, but with the same thick accent and his features cast in the same mould. A tall man, however, only an inch or so shorter than Peter. But both of the South Africans were suspicious and resentful, and the reason was immediately apparent. "I have been instructed to take my orders from you, General." And there was a subtle shift of position, the 2 officers ranging themselves beside Peter, but facing each other. And he was aware instantly that not all the hostility was directed at him. There had been friction between police and military already, and the basic value of Atlas was underlined yet again. A single, clean-cut line of command and of responsibility was absolutely essential. Peter's mind flicked back to the shootout at Larnaca Airport between Egyptian commandos and Cypriot National Guardsmen, from which the hijackers of the grounded jet emerged unscathed, while the airfield was littered with the burning wreckage of the Egyptian transport aircraft and dozens of dead and dying Cypriots and Egyptians. The first principle of terrorist strategy was to strike at the point where national responsibilities were blurred. Atlas cut through that. "Thank you." Peter accepted command without flaunting it. "My backup team will land in just over 3 hours' time. We will, of course, use force only as a last resort. But if it comes to that, I will use exclusively Atlas personnel in any counter-strike. I would like to make that quite clear immediately." And he saw the line of the soldier's mouth harden with disappointment. "My men are the elite. It's a British aircraft. Most of the hostages are British or American nationals. It's a political decision, Colonel. But I would value your help in other areas." Peter turned him aside tactfully. "Firstly, I want you to suggest a position where I can place my surveillance equipment, and then we will go over the ground together." Peter had no difficulty selecting his forward observation post. The service manager's roomy, sparsely furnished office on the 3rd floor of the terminal building overlooked the entire service area and the southern portion of the taxiway where the Boeing stood. The windows had been left open when the offices were evacuated, so there was no need to change the external appearance of the room. The overhang of the observation balcony on the floor above shaded the interior, and the office was deep enough to ensure that an observer out there in the bright glare of sunshine would not be able to see into the room, even with a powerful lens. The militants would expect surveillance from the glass control tower high above. Any deception, however trivial, was worthwhile. The surveillance equipment was lightweight and compact. The television cameras were neither of them bigger than a Super 8 home movie camera, and a man could carry in one hand both of the aluminium extension tripods. However, the cameras could zoom to 800mm focal length, and they repeated on the screens of the command console in the cabin of the Hawker, while the image was simultaneously stored on videotape. The audio intensifier was more bulky, but no heavier. It had a 4-foot dish antenna with the sound collector in the centre. The telescopic sight could aim the intensifier at a sound source with the accuracy of a sniper's rifle, could focus on the lips of a human being at 800 yards distance, and clearly record normal conversation at that range, passing sound directly to the command console, and at the same time storing it on the big magnetic tape spools. Two of Peter's communications team were posted here, with a plentiful supply of coffee and donuts, and Peter, accompanied by the South African colonel and his staff, went up in the elevator to the glass house of the control tower. From the air traffic control tower, there was an unobstructed view across the airfield and over the apron and service areas around the terminal. The observation platform below the tower had been cleared of all but military personnel. "I have roadblocks at all the main entrances to the airfield. Only passengers with confirmed reservations and current tickets are being allowed through. No thrill seekers, and we are using only the northern section of the terminal for traffic." Peter nodded and turned to the senior controller. "What is the state of your traffic pattern?" "We've refused clearance to all private flights incoming and departing. All domestic scheduled flights have been rerouted to Lanseria and Germiston airports, and we are landing and dispatching only international scheduled flights. But the backlog has delayed departures by 3 hours." "What separation are you observing from 070? Peter asked. "Fortunately, the international departures terminal is the farthest from the aircraft, and we are not using the taxiways or the apron of the southern section. As you see, we've cleared the entire area. Except for those 3 SA Airways aircraft, which are undergoing overhaul and servicing, there are no other aircraft within 1,000 yards of 070. "I may have to freeze all traffic if..." Peter paused. "Or should I say, when we have an escalation?" "Very well, sir." "In the meantime, you may continue as you are at present." Peter lifted his binoculars and once again very carefully examined the huge Boeing. It stood in stately isolation, silent and seemingly abandoned. The bright, almost gaudy marking gave her a carnival air. Red and blue and crisp, sparkling white in the brilliant sunlight of the Highveld. She was parked fully broadside to the tower, and all her hatches and doors were still armed and locked. Peter traversed slowly along the line of perspex windows down the length of the fuselage, but over each of them the sunshades had been firmly closed from the interior, turning them into the multiple eyes of a blinded insect. Peter lifted his scrutiny slightly onto the windshield and side panels of the flight deck. These again had been screened with blankets, hung over them from inside, completely thwarting any glimpse of the crew or their captors, and certainly preventing a shot into the flight deck, although the range from the nearest corner of the terminal was not more than 400 yards, and with the new laser sights, one of Thor's trained snipers could pick through which eye of the human head he would put a bullet.